It's Wednesday, February 23rd, 2011, Theories of Knowledge. So I was just saying that if you didn't do so well on the exams and you wanted some help, come by office hours. I am there. If you're there right on the hour and I'm not there, that doesn't mean I'm blowing off my office hours. It means I was in a meeting that went over or some other contingency. And you know, give me at least a five-minute courtesy wait before you take off. So, and I'm also available at times other than my office hours. So those are the times I'm required to be there, but I can be there at other times. And I have time between 11 and 1 on Tuesdays and Thursdays. That's a good day to see me. And also Wednesdays after class, although probably not today. But generally Wednesday after class, I don't have to be anywhere right away. In between 3:30 and 4:30, I have free as well. So, and then final exam office hours will be different than the regular term, and I'll announce those in week 10. So that's another time when you might be able to get a hold of me, and I have a pretty free schedule. After the 10th week, it's pretty much I'm determining final grades and meeting with students, and I don't have any classes to do. So, and most of my administrative stuff is done. So that's a time when I have a lot of time on my hands. So, or when, I never have a lot of time on my hands, but I have more than usual during final exam week. So if you want to come in for a half an hour, an hour, and just have me grill you about material which will be in the final, I'm happy to do so. And that's something that can, apart from like the normal things you do for studying, like making sure you're absolutely clear on which philosophers believe which things, on what certain key terms mean, on the various arguments pro and con for different theories. And those, there shouldn't be any surprises on the exam. And I think that looking over the exam when I added a curve, I saw people, they didn't know what idealism is. if you're at the exam and the question is idealism is, and it gives you five definitions, and you don't immediately recognize the correct definition, you're doing something wrong in your study, right? Because when you're reading through the text, you see the word idealism, it's in bold, you see the definition. There's a question at the end of the section that says, define idealism. We talk about idealism in class, the view that only mental or spiritual exists. You want to make sure that when you see that term idealism, on your note card you could write, idealism, only the mental or spiritual exists. And then you'll get that question right. I understand people have test anxiety and other problems with testing, but you know, the test isn't meant to have, it doesn't have trick questions on it. There were a few that are ambiguous, which is one of the reasons why I added a curve. Like, for example, people still thought on Berkeley, you know, did Berkeley agree with Locke's concept of substance? Well, if you understand what Locke's concept of substance is, it's the concept of material substance, right? You know, in the dialogue, he says, you know, what do you call it, material substratum or substance, and they talk about it in the dialogue. And then, you know, you look at and read the commentary section after all the long, you know, flowery back and forth between Hylas and Philonous, and he says, Berkeley's attack on matter. You know, Berkeley attacks the idea there's a material world. And, you know, we talk about that in class, too. And the students are raising their hands saying, how can anybody believe it's such a crazy thing as there isn't a material world? But somehow, when they come to the test, they get a question that says, what does Berkeley think about Locke's concept of substance? And they put, oh, well, he kind of goes along. He has some minor reservations, but he goes along with it for the most part. wrong. How could you say something more wrong? But a significant number of people checked that, put a click on that box. So if you just remember, like, simple things like Berkeley, you know, crazy, doesn't believe in the material world. What does he believe in? He believes there's minds and you have ideas put in your mind by God. Okay. And so it's hard. You know, it's hard for me to understand how someone could either read the text or skim the text and read the commentary section at least, and then come to class and not like get questions like that. So, what are you going to do? But you know, maybe I'm missing something. So, and that's what office hours are for. So, if you are struggling with the class, I understand this isn't like your history class. It's conceptual. It's not just rote memorization. Although, you know, idealism—that's a rote memorization question. But there are other questions that ask you to apply concepts. Like there's one, a priori, a posteriori. Basic questions, and I think, those are going to come up on the final too. So you got to make sure you understand a priori, a posteriori. Analytic and synthetic. And there's a question, what is an analytic statement? And I don't always use like all the examples I use in class. So the question is, which of the following is a synthetic statement? And there was one, the president is the chief executive officer of the United States. Well, that's just a definition of what the president is, right? You have three branches of government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial, right? Some congressmen don't know the three branches of the government. I heard some Democratic congressman said, we have three branches of the government. I think it was like Chuck Schumer or something. We got the Congress, the Senate, and the President. No. So I understand if you don't get that. But if you understand like the President, who is the President defined as? He's the Chief Executive Officer of the United States. He's the head of the executive branch. That's a definition. And then there were some other ones like the triangle.
What was the right answer for that? Because I know I clicked on that one.
That was the correct answer. Synthetic statement. Which of the following is a synthetic statement? So that is not a fact about the president. It's the essence or definition of what the president is. It's analytic. Because the predicate is contained in the subject. So the predicate, chief executive officer, is contained in the subject, the president. So the president, if you understand what a president is, you understand he's head of the executive branch. That's just what a president is. So it's not, now some of the other ones, so an analytic statement is one where the predicate is contained in the subject. So it's like, the president is the CEO of the United States is like a bachelor is an unmarried male. Analytic. I think the other one was a triangle has three sides. Analytic or synthetic?
Analytic,
right? Because if you understand what a triangle is, you understand that statement's true. A triangle has four sides. That one might be kind of tricky. Is that a analytic or synthetic?
Analytically false.
Yeah, analytically false. So again, you can have an analytic statement that's false. So, but it's, you know, if it were true, the subject would be contained in the predicate. And I admit that was kind of a tricky one. But nobody actually picked that one, or very few people picked that one. And then the last one was Pythagoras was a vegetarian. Now, is that part of the definition of Pythagoras, or is that a fact about Pythagoras, which could have been otherwise? Yeah, so that's the synthetic statement. So it's just that, and I think in class I use the president is Barack Obama, or Barack Obama is the, let's see what, no, I think in class I use Barack Obama is the president of the United States. You don't really have a definition of a person. If I said like Barack Obama is a human being, I suppose that's kind of you might float that as an analytic statement. But you know, Barack Obama as the president of the United States is synthetic because it's not true by definition, and it's, you know, going to change in maybe 2 years, maybe 6 years, right? But it's going to change eventually. So that can't be an analytic statement because analytic statements are true by definition, and it's not true by definition that the president is Barack Obama, because there have been lots of other presidents besides him. And so that's a synthetic statement. So I didn't use like Barack Obama as the president of the United States, but I used something where you had to apply the concept. So if you understood what a synthetic statement was, you should have said, okay, Pythagoras. Can I like just think about the concept of Pythagoras and think, oh, he's a vegetarian? No, it's just like a fact about him. As opposed to the triangle, you should know, oh, it has three sides. That's contained in the concept of the triangle. There is no concept of Pythagoras that you can say contains being a vegetarian. So that's just a fact about Pythagoras. Anyway, so that was an application concept. And, you know, that's one that requires you to not just memorize, but be able to apply particular concepts to apply general concepts to particular things. And then there's like pro and con arguments, and some of that's more rote memorization. So anyway, I understand that not everybody, some people say, oh, I'm doing an A in my math class, but I'm getting a C minus in your philosophy class. And so people have different skill sets. So I understand that, and again, I'm here to help. And office hour, then I won't berate you and beat you up for missing questions. I'm just sort of giving a general rant about like the things we need to do to pass the class or to get a good grade is, you know, terms, who were the philosophers, what are their views, the arguments pro and con, and then really understanding some of these key concepts and be able to apply them to particular examples. And if you can do those four things, then you'll excel in the exam. So let's talk about Kierkegaard. I think we're supposed to be talking about religious knowledge this week, and we didn't talk about. So Kierkegaard is sort of religious knowledge, but he's also in the section on belief and will. So
Kierkegaard is a name,
which is why his name is so hard to spell. He's regarded the first existentialist. Now, generally today, existentialism is associated with atheism. Kierkegaard is a Christian existentialist. And so part of the existential view, you know, someone want to describe what is existentialism? The title of Jean-Paul Sartre's book, What is Existentialism? It takes a whole book to explain.
Separate from God?
I think that's part of Kierkegaard. I think that might be part of Kierkegaard's definition. It has to do with our alienation towards God. But what's existentialism about?
The belief that ordinary life is absurd.
Yeah. Ordinary day-to-day life is absurd. What does that mean? Or meaningless. I don't know if this fits right. I'm just thinking about an idea of an absurdity. It's an old Benny Hill joke. It's a British comedian. He's hanging out at the disco, dancing with his honey, and she's telling him that he should quit being so lazy and get a job. And he's like, well, why should I do that? And she says, well, you could, you know, earn a bunch of money and save it up. And he's like, well, why would I want to do that? Well, then you could retire and you wouldn't have to work anymore. And he said, well, I'm not working now. Right? So the existentialism hits on that kind of absurdity that well, you know, what do? You go to school to learn a bunch of stuff. Why? So you can get a job. Then you get a job and you earn a bunch of money. Why do you do that? Well, so you can buy your house and you can like start a family and have a bunch of kids. Why do you do that? Well, you know, you sort of, it's what everybody else does. Yeah. And then it's like, and then what do? You go to the movies to forget your job that works your bone and all your stresses, and you go out and try to do some fun stuff. And why? To forget all the questions that plague you, like, why am I here? What is the meaning of my life? Why is my boss always yelling at me? And then you work for, you know, 30 or 40 years until you're old, and then you start thinking about death, and then you get really sick, and you call Dean Adele and complain about your bursitis, and then finally you kick the bucket and you're dead, and that's the end. And you think, well, what's the point, right? And then maybe you spend your whole life like collecting stamps or something, or Star Wars memorabilia or whatever it is, right? Or you hone some really great skills, like you become a master violinist or Scrabble player, or you become an expert at video games, or maybe you learn how to paint or something, and you're a world-renowned painter. But then, like, what happens to all that stuff? Well, you die and that's the end of it, and maybe people keep your work around and appreciate it, but then why do you care? You're dead. You know, after you're dead, are you going to get appreciation from them? So the idea is you go through your life, you know, doing stuff. You do one thing so you can do another thing. You do that thing so you can do this next thing. And the grass always seems greener on the other side of the hill. And you're spinning your wheels, you know, two steps forward, one step back. And finally, you get to the end of it all, and you think, oh, I'm so tired, and all my bones ache, and I'm just kind of hanging out here waiting for death. And then you keel over, and that was it. And you think, well, what's the point? What's the point of a life that ends in death? What's the point of all this rigmarole I go through with my career and trying to, you know? And you say, well, my meaning is like trying to help people. Well, they're going to die too, so their life is as temporary as yours is. And so it all, after a while, kind of seems like shifting sand. So you get this, the famous speech in Macbeth. I'll watch it. Any acting people?
So the tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying nothing.
There you go, yeah. out, brief candle, right? Your life's a poor player that frets and struts upon the stage and then is seen no more, right? So you think about like having a bit part, right? You come out and you're like the fool and you do your little, you say you're like, you know, two lines, like, I'll have what she's having, or you know, whatever it is, and then that's the end of you. And then you exit stage left. And then you know the audience doesn't see you anymore. And that's kind of like what your life, like this brief candle that burns for a while and then burns down to the wick and goes out. And the tale told by an idiot is sort of like the idea of, I think maybe the idiot there is some, you know, the idiot is old English for like a mentally handicapped person. So I don't know if you know any people that have like a developmental disability, but they tell you some long incomprehensible story and it makes no sense. You know, this is sort of like, this is sort of like the picture that Shakespeare is giving of like some incoherent story told by a person with a brain disorder. You know, that's what life is like. You can't make any sense out of it. It's crazy. And then it's gone. And so that's the sort of existential insight. But then the question is, what do you do about it? And Kierkegaard says, well, look, you have first there's sort of the ordinary life, and that's meaningless. And then you get a certain level of meaning in the moral life, in living your life in an ethical fashion, in obeying ethical principles, in caring for other people. And that gives, according to Kierkegaard, your life a certain sense of meaning. But really, you don't get the full sense of meaning until you go into the religious life of the life of faith. And that's where the real meaning is to be found in life. Why? Because you realize that your life doesn't end in death, that there is an afterlife. And as you go through life, you are cognizant of the fact that that it has meaning precisely because it doesn't end. And so that informs all of your living, in that if you're living the life of faith, if you're living your life with the cognizance that there's a God and the God has a plan for your life, then it sort of informs your moral life and your ordinary life and infuses those things with meaning. So without this religious component, these things, I think you'd say this would be completely meaningless. This wouldn't be as meaningful. So this sort of, that the religious life infuses your moral life and even your ordinary mundane life with new meaning. And so that's his sort of hierarchy of values. And so he thinks meaning is to be found in the life of faith, and that's sort of the only place you can find meaning, true meaning. So what do you thought? Any thoughts about this? About the life is absurd. Is life absurd? Is faith the answer to the absurd life? Could the moral life be sufficient in itself? Yeah.
Isn't like the religious life just a kind of an extension of the moral life? Like, how does he find the meaning of that? And does he think that is like eternal or something? Like, I don't see why he doesn't want to have any, or why it's meaningless in the moral life to live. Looking forward to the religious life, isn't that kind of like the same thing?
Yeah,
looking forward to another goal.
I think he sees these as different than being goals, Isaac.
He thinks that like you need to abandon objectivity in favor of an inward subjectivity. You need to embrace like passion with the paradox of life, and at that point where you take, I think he coined the phrase, a leap of faith, is when you really like have meaning. Everything else is kind of shallow.
You have different goals in life, but the mundane goals themselves he thinks as being full of futility. Because you think about, like, you have an ambition for a career, So what's that going to get you? Well, a bunch of money. What are you going to do with that money? Spend it on yourself, right? Or maybe use it to help other people, right? You're going to die and they're going to die. So after you spend all that money and you get some pleasure and you help some other people, and then everybody dies at the end. Well, he would say, what's the point of that? Whereas if you're living a life of faith, you're doing something which is significant because it's everlasting. Because you will have a future life with God, and this is sort of a part of that. So he doesn't see the religious life as something subjective where you're having certain kinds of subjective experiences and you die anyway. He thinks religion is real, and that faith has a real object, and that it's part of an eternal relationship, and it sort of gives your life a cosmic meaning, as opposed to the kind of materialist idea, which is that your life, is just, you're born, you live, and you die, and that's it. And you do some stuff in between. But it all ultimately turns to dust. You think about, like, most people, even, like, famous people. There are a lot of famous people that nobody's ever heard of. Why? Because they're a long time ago. I think of someone, Frederick Marsh. Have you heard of Frederick Marsh? He's like an old movie star. He used to be like one of the most famous people out there. Who's that woman? John Wilkes Booth used to be a famous actor. Now he's known for something else. I have a problem thinking of it. Theda Bara. She used to be as famous as Marilyn Monroe was in the 50s, and I suppose you pick your favorite person, a sex symbol today. And most people haven't heard her as well. So you kind of think of people that were really famous even, less than 100 years ago, and people don't remember them. It's only like certain, like very few great people, and sometimes it's an accident of history. Your average Joe, nobody's going to remember you. Your family might remember you for a while. You might be in an old photo album someplace, but, how many of you remember know anything about your great-great-grandfather, or you just go one generation past those? Anybody that was born, before 1900. Probably, unless you're related to genealogy, you don't know anything about those people. So it's not like your family's going to carry on your memory. So you and everything you do, chances are, it's going to be gone. Unless you're like a famous artist or, famous movie producer or something. But even then, like I said, most of those people, you don't remember them. So Kierkegaard says that part of having a meaningful life is having a sort of eternal perspective. And also, it's just like the idea of the leap of faith is, the question is like, how do you know? So if you say, okay, the religious life, if it's real, maybe it gives me meaning. If religion is a delusion, and there is no real God, and religion is just a creation of man, then it seems like, I think Kierkegaard would agree that it's just, it's more absurdity, right? It's even more absurd because you live your whole life living for God, and it turns out there isn't a God, and it's just oblivion and nothingness. That's really absurd. And so then the question is, how do you know? And Kierkegaard does suggest you need to take this sort of leap of faith. You need to make a decision, to believe.
So does he believe on the bet then? The Pascal's wager?
Actually, he doesn't like Pascal's wager. I think he sees that as sort of cynical, that you're kind of playing the odds. He would say that you don't need to weigh the odds, and that if you're thinking what's going to pay off, that you've kind of missed the point.
He's got a good argument, though.
Pascal?
Yeah.
We didn't finish analyzing Pascal's wager, did we? We kind of talked a little bit about it, but we didn't. Did we talk about criticisms of it? I think we ran up against the clock. Let's come back. Let's come back. We'll come back to Pascal's wager in a second. Kierkegaard thinks you need to make this leap of faith, and he says subjectivity is good. Maybe I should make a distinction.
Pascal. Let's go back to Pascal. So why does Pascal's wager seem to be a good argument? What appeals to it?
Just that you can live a better life by just trying to feel connected.
You know, what do you mean by better?
Maybe moral, by living a moral life, be more kind, giving, having charity in your life.
So that means help spend all your time and resources making other people happy instead of making yourself happy?
Would that be a piece of the pie? Wouldn't be the whole pie.
Sounds like a lot of work to me. It's like, if I'm thinking about, you know, my own happiness, it's like, I should do things to make me happy. Why should I go down, like, you know, give money to homeless people, work in the soup kitchen, volunteer, and, you know, go around helping people? That seems like a sacrifice. I mean, unless you really enjoy helping people. But yeah, it seems like there's a point. And think of all, it seems like, as a religious person, if you're sort of traditionally religious, think of all the stuff you're going to miss out on. For example, when you're young, you're all vigorous and potent, and an unmarried person. Most people when they're young really enjoy hooking up and having sex with a bunch of different partners. And for men, it's sort of culturally accepted. For women, you know, if you have too many people, maybe there's a sort of ostracism, but not so much anymore. And, you know, human beings really enjoy sex. So when you're young and you got all those hormones raging, you're thinking, I want to go out tonight and hook up with some random person, right? Maybe more of a male thing than a woman thing, although I think things are changing in that respect too. But if you're a religious person, it's like, no, wait until you're married, you know. And then you can't even enjoy, like, you know, watching, a soft porn movie on Skinamax, right? On your cable, right? But I used to feel guilty about it. You're like, oh, like, I shouldn't be watching this. And you can't even enjoy a good dirty joke. Right? So you have to make all these sacrifices. You read the Bible, pray, and go to church, and feel bad about the stuff you do, and you can't, like, you know, go out and get drunk, and that wild party you got to think about spiritual things. And, I mean, not to say that you're not going to get some benefits. I mean, I think Pascal makes a good case to get some benefits, and William James makes a good case about that too. But it's not like there's no sacrifice on the other side. There's a lot of sacrifice. And if you're a Christian, Jesus says he wants you to take up your cross and follow him. Well, that's like a big sacrifice. It's not like you just show up for church and you know, sing a bunch of hymns and then get to go eat donuts or something, right? If you want to be a real Christian, the kind of Christian that Kierkegaard is talking about, you have to sacrifice. You have to die yourself. That's a pretty big sacrifice, right? To metaphorically die to yourself. Now again, you get these benefits, but it's not like there's no. It's not like there's no trade-off. So I think that Pascal paints an overly rosy picture of the payoff for religion. So believe, don't believe, and then God exists. And God doesn't exist. So God exists and you believe, and again, this sort of jackpot. Here you win some. This will be a good test question. This is the important category for Pascal's wager, that if you believe in God doesn't exist, you still win. And I think that's probably the most controversial claim of the argument, and this is what the argument hinges on. Whereas I would say, one criticism is it ignores the sacrifice of the religious life. That sacrifice required of the religious life. And maybe it's going to be more of a break-even point. Or maybe you might even lose some.
I mean, how can you really judge if you win or lose if there's no God, no afterlife? It seems like it would just be a moot point. Because all his what you win after is based on what happens after you die. Like, you hit the jackpot if you believe and he exists, and that's, you gain that after you die. You lose everything if you don't believe and God exists, but you only reap those benefits after you die.
But you still, this idea of winning some, it accounts what happens in this life, though. The idea is that even if there's nothing after this life, and you live your life as a religious person, and it turns out you were wrong the whole time, you still get some benefit. So that benefit has to be this life. So the question is, are you really being, is the benefit, is he sort of playing up the benefits and ignoring the sacrifice? And so again, if you think about, like, you know, Pascal was a Catholic. So I don't know if anybody here is, you know, grew up Catholic, go to Catholic Mass. Most people see it as kind of a drudgery. They're like, oh, I guess I should go to Mass. And you get some comfort and you have some positive feelings if you're raised in it. It sort of makes you think about your childhood. Now, some people really get into the mystery and the symbols and the religion. But most of the people I know who are Catholic, even the devout ones, say that Mass can kind of be a drudgery. It's better that it's not in Latin anymore, but it's, you know, not that exciting. Now, if you're a Pentecostal, maybe it's, you know, but you're sure it's a little more exciting. But still, I don't say anything necessarily bad about Catholicism, but if you talk to people who believe in Catholicism, they'll admit, yeah, my favorite thing to do in the whole wide world isn't going to church. Whereas I think there, you might get some people that would be the case in some other faiths where they have a more kind of exciting service. But even those people, I think, you think, well, you're reading the Book of Leviticus and, you know, it's not that interesting to me, but I feel like it's my religious duty. Do I like, you know, thinking about, do I like watching myself to make sure I try not to sin so much? And it's kind of like, it's a discipline, right? Finding time, time out of my day to pray, to worship God, you know, that. And those things are all sacrifice, in addition to, you know, not be able to go along with the crowd and do things like go out drinking with your friends or, going out, you know, some Christians are, you know, observant, and so they won't go out and see the usual Hollywood fare, which is, you know, sex and violence and profanity, right? So, or at least if they do, they feel a little guilty. You can't even swear. I had this guy who's a Nazarene, and he would say peas and rice, instead, so he wouldn't take the Lord's name in vain.
So I could see how you could say that you would win something, and the fact that, like, religion in the past has drawn boundaries for people's health, like, say, kosher foods, you know, prevents people from eating pigs, which has traditionally been more prone to disease and made people more sick, and, you know, alcoholism is not exactly the most healthiest state, so I can see how some of these prohibitions can, in a way, you can win some if you believe, but God doesn't exist, and at least you live by these rules that theoretically have been created to make our lives healthier and safe. But then where he says win some, what hurts me is thinking about how, well, then you've given your life to something outside of yourself, and then you don't have that autonomy, you don't have that sense of individuality to grow on, you don't get to develop fully as an individual, and so that's where clenches my heart, and I feel terrible about that. I don't see
this
winning, really.
Yeah, so maybe you sacrifice some choices, sacrifice, I'll put individuality with the question here. Although you're kind of the odd man out in society, being observant and devout Christian in America, you're kind of going to be depending on what, maybe if you're living in the South, it might be more of you, but especially in Virginia here, it's a tough road. But sacrificing, there might be some questions. The thing you said about the kosher, I'm thinking, what's more delicious than bacon or a ham sandwich? It's like one of the most delicious foods in the world. But if you're an observant Jew, it's like no ham for you. Right, so you can't eat ham, and it's like, you know, and if you're an evangelical Christian, or really any kind of, you know, real Christian, it's like, you know, hooking up, getting drunk, enjoying a good dirty joke. Those are all, you know, there are a bunch of hypocrites out there that do that stuff anyway. But if you really want to follow this stuff, you shouldn't be doing any of those things.
Now, isn't it true though, if all the religions could eat different meat, or that everyone could eat whatever, there wouldn't be enough food to go around? Like, if it benefits us that this mass population that is a certain religion can't eat this type of meat, that makes it so that there's enough for other populations to have it?
No, just there aren't that many Jews around anyway. If there were,
like Hindus don't eat beef, right?
I suppose if Hindus ate beef and Muslims ate pigs, it would just drive up the price. But I mean, there'd still be plenty to go around. You just get the supply increasing. Yeah.
I think it's really based on the time that it came forward as well, because the Hindu population not eating their cattle, I heard, was due to the fact that if famine comes through and they eat the cow, then they're not going to have the milk in 2 weeks. And so in the long run, it's actually going to hurt them. And so it's the only way they could keep people in times of starvation from eating their cows is to make them sacred.
Right.
And so, I just very idealistic thinking that all of these religions had a purpose to protect people when they're coming into this stuff.
Sure, and that might be like a reason now. There's no reason now with modern refrigeration that you shouldn't be able to enjoy a ham sandwich or popcorn shrimp or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Shellfish being non-kosher probably comes from people with there's a fairly common allergy, fairly common being, I don't know, maybe 5% of the population has an allergy to shellfish. So, in ancient times, somebody has a shellfish and his lung passes, his throat closes up and he suffocates, and they're like, oh, better stay away from this stuff, and then it gets incorporated in the religion. But this actually raises another point in that Jews will eat beef and Muslims, but not pork. Muslims won't eat pork. Hindus can't eat beef. And I don't know what the deal is. Can they eat pigs? I think their pigs are okay. But Hindus won't eat the sacred cow. Muslims and Jews won't eat pork, but they will eat the sacred cow. So the question is, which one do you go with? If you're going to have a religion, right? So the second problem is, which God are you going to believe in, or which religion?
One thing all religions have in common is that they all think they're right.
There you go. So, and they all can't be right because they teach contradictory things. And Pascal sort of assumes you kind of believe in a generic God and you're going to be okay. But he's like a Catholic, so what if you're a Protestant? Catholic doctrine at Pascal's time was all the Protestants were going to hell. Now the Catholic Church says not only Hindus and Muslims and devout Jews can go to heaven, but yes, even Protestants can be saved just by following their own religion. So you have this question of how do you figure out which religion is the right one to follow? And most of these religions, too, they say people that follow the other religions, they're all, God's going to punish them. So you get this in Islam, you get this in Christianity. Judaism, to a certain extent, about the idolaters. So, Jews take a dim view, and the Old Testament takes a dim view of people that worship idols, which includes a billion Hindus. The Muslims say the idolaters and it depends on different things. It's their deal on Jews and Christians is sort of iffy. I think on the Christians, it's a lot more condemnatory. So you have all these religions which conflict with each other. So you got to figure out which one is the right one, because otherwise, if you pick the wrong one, God's going to punish you. But then it seems like you're not gambling in God. You're gambling which religion is true. And then how do you just like? You, this isn't going to work anymore, right? Are you going to try to follow them all? That's going to work, because if you follow one religion, you're going to have to break the commandments of another religion. If you follow what they all have in common, then you're going to get that your religion is going to be really sparse and minimal. So you can't, this grid isn't going to work if you're talking about religion anymore, because you have to gamble on some religion. Or you'll have to use reason. But Pascal says reason can't tell you which. That's why you start gambling. So I think those are two major flaws in this argument. The third thing is, will God
think we talked about this briefly. Will God reward spiritual gamblers? And then the fourth problem is, will he punish, you know, unbelievers? Unbelief, let's say. Disbelief.
And I gave the example in class, I think this is the last thing I did. I said, imagine I say, you know, there's a pop quiz right now, and what's my favorite color? Right? Or, you know, what's the capital exterior? Or something, what's my favorite color is better, right? Because then you have to, like, guess on what my favorite color is. And in a way, that seems like an unfair question because it's not really the class. But moreover, there's no way you could ever know what that is. I mean, you could guess, right? I might have noticed that I have a champagne-colored Toyota. And you're like, that's kind of an exotic color, champagne. That's what the Toyota people call it anyway. So you think, okay, maybe it's champagne. So you think, well, he's wearing that yellow shirt today. Maybe he likes yellow.
The coffee cup
is purple. Maybe it's purple. And actually, yellow and purple are two of my favorite colors. But, you know, you have to pick one, right? Do I like purple more? Do I like yellow more? Yeah, so he's always writing with that black pen. Maybe it's black. Right? And that's the situation you are with religion. It's like, if God's sort of given you a test and says, okay, pick the right religion, and if you don't pick the wrong one, if you pick the wrong one, who's the God of the real religion, is going to send you to hell if you're picking the wrong one. That's, in a way, that seems like kind of an unfair test because you have all these different holy books, right? You got the Bible, you got the Quran, you got the Book of Mormon, which is like an add-on to the Bible. You got the Bhagavad Gita and the Hindu Upanishads. You got the Tao Te Ching and Taoism. You got, you know, the Confucius and his Analects, and you got and all these sort of indigenous traditions that don't really have sacred texts and they're based on oral traditions. And then you got these kind of New Age religions, and you got Scientology, and I mean, you have all these different, and then there's like the particular interpretations, right? So in Christianity, you get Catholicism, and you got Protestantism, and there's some conflict between those two. And then in Islam, you got three major traditions, the Sunnis, the Shias, and the Sufis. And you have sects of these other religions too, and then subsects within those sects, right? So there's the major strains of the religions, and then these subsects. Like in Christianity, you got the Protestants, you got, you know, 100 different Protestant denominations. Now, I suppose you might say the Protestant denominations are pretty much the same. In Buddhism, you got so many forms of Buddhism, it's ridiculous. You have like a sort of agnostic philosophy of Theravada Buddhism. You got the sort of mystical Zen Buddhism, and then you got the Nichiren Shoshu Buddhism, which is chant Nam Myoho Renge Kyo for health, wealth, and prosperity. And those are totally different views. Yeah.
If you can root out certain religions as having internal contradictions, could you then justly believe that they're false?
Well, that's going back to reason then, but then you're not gambling anymore. So I think that what Pascal's saying, there's no way to tell whether there's a God or not rationally. So what do? You hedge your bet, and you bet on God because it's going to pay off. Because the worst that's going to happen to you if you don't believe in God and doesn't exist, you break even. The best that will happen to you if you believe in God doesn't exist, you're going to win something. But that's assuming there's no way to tell. And so if you're picking a particular religion, then if you're using reason, why not? That's sort of a different attack.
Wouldn't the number one argument against this is there is a way to tell?
Yeah, I mean, you can take that tact, or you might say, well, there is a way to tell. And then, again, if it's just guesswork, is God really going to punish you for guessing wrong? Would be one thing. And then, you know, how would you tell which, if you're going to bet on God, which God do you bet on? So, and then to decide which God you bet on, there's either two ways to do it, right? Randomly, or you use your reason. Well, if you're using your reason, you're not gambling anymore.
Yeah, how can he punish you for not choosing if he never came and told you directly? You know, to believe in
them. Well, I mean, it could be that there's one religion that if you like did a little investigation, it would turn out that it's the one that makes the most sense, that maybe there's a lot of evidence for it, and it might turn out the other religions, like if you investigate Scientology, you say, oh, this was like created by some lunatic science fiction writer as a part of the bed at a top cocktail party. and with a bunch of other sci-fi writers that he could start his own religion, and it was just a scam to make money and become famous. Or maybe you investigate Mormonism and you find out that Joseph Smith was actually convicted of the crime of money digging, of conning people into paying them to search for buried treasure on their property using occult powers of his occult powers of a seer. And then he claims to dig up these plates of the lost plates of the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon, you might make you think, well, it's that might make me wonder about some guy that's actually jailed and convicted of a crime for money digging is what the crime was called. That might make you wonder. And so and you might like investigate the different religions. You look at the Quran and you see the stuff about the jihad and about the unbelievers should be if you leave Islam you have to be executed, and there's a bunch of misogynist stuff about women should be beaten if they're disobedient to their husbands. And so you might say, well, and you look at Muhammad himself, and he married a 6-year-old girl, and so would God choose a pedophile as a prophet? So you can kind of go down the line. You're like, nope, not that one. But you'd be using your reason. You wouldn't be saying, well, which religion is going to pay off for me? Which is going to be, the most fun. So anyway, so I think there are some serious questions about this wager. I think ultimately the gambling bit doesn't work, but using the reason to try to figure out which religion is the right one might be more fruitful. But that's different than Pascal's idea, and also different than Kierkegaard's idea. So Kierkegaard's, again, I think you could say the same problem with this. So Kierkegaard says subjectivity, when you have subjectivity, you have passion, you have a kind of a relationship with God. And you treat God as a person or a subject. That's part of it. Or as an objectivity, you use reason. You're analyzing God, and you treat God as an object. And so he says that this is what the way you need to go when it comes to God. You take this leap of faith, stop trying to analyze it, stop trying to understand it, but just believe. And then you'll be rewarded with all the things that come from the life of faith. And that to the extent that you're treating God as an object, you're not going to be able to have a relationship with him. And it's sort of like if you think about a relationship with a spouse, right? So in order to have a relationship with another person, there's elements like trust and communication. And if you treat your significant other as an other, as a person you don't have a relationship with, and you're always analyzing what they do, like you might say, well, my spouse isn't home yet. I wonder if they're having an affair. Maybe I should check up on them, right? That shows a lack of trust. If you're always analyzing what the other person says or what they do, that's not going to be very good for the relationship. Suppose you're wondering, like, oh, how much does my spouse love me? And you keep a log of, like, all the different things they do throughout the day, and whether they show love, whether they show the opposite of love or something that's sort of not one way or the other. And you like comes in at the end of the day and like, well, I've been keeping a log of how loving you are today. And I'm seeing that it's a 72%. It's not very good. I think you should, to really prove that you love me, I'd like to see some higher marks and doing the dishes. And that's not going to be good for the relationship, right? Because you're analyzing the way the person is behaving towards you. A relationship, you throw all that stuff out the window, and you love the person, and you expect that they love you back. You have trust. You have a mutual relationship. And if you're always analyzing God, trying to figure out whether God really exists, and whether God really loves you or not, and whether God really has your best interests at heart, then you're not really going to have a relationship with God. You're going to be alienated from God. So that, and he has a point here about even about the subjectivity. He talks about this idea of kind of apologetics, which is really popular now, Christian apologetics, that trying to prove that the Bible is historically reliable, that it's trustworthy, that all the books of the Bible belong there and no others. And this is a little quote here. So, page 182. Oh, just a little clue on trying to understand Kierkegaard. He says things like the third paragraph from the bottom of 182. Although I am still an outsider of the faith, I can see that the only impartible sin against the majesty of Christianity is for the individual to take his relationship for granted. Now, when he's saying he's an outsider of the faith, he takes on this kind of faith persona when he's writing. So he's portraying himself as an unbeliever who's sort of, you know, through the process of becoming a Christian. So that's why he says that. So Kierkegaard really is, I mean, Kierkegaard's an insider. He is a Christian. But he's sort of pretending, he's taking on a kind of a role where he's pretending he's this person that's not too sure about Christianity and wondering what he should do. So he's writing this under a pseudonym. Let's see. Yeah, he has his name in here. Okay, anyway. So he says that the objective problem is Christianity true? The subjective problem is, what is the individual's relationship to Christianity? Quite simply, how may I, Johann Climacus, so this is his pseudonym that he's writing, and this role he's taking on, participate in the happiness promised by Christianity? The problem concerns myself alone. So then he says, and actually I'll just read this part in 183. The objective problem of the truth of Christianity. From an objective point of view, Christianity is a historical fact, which must be considered in a purely objective manner. For the modest scholar, it is far too objective to leave himself outside. Though, as a matter of fact, he may count himself as a believer. So he's you know, thinking that people that maybe haven't considered Christianity objectively, they still might be a believer anyway. Truth, in this objective sense, may mean either historical truth, you know, that all the events of the Bible actually happened, or two, philosophical truth. As historical truth, the truth claims must be decided by critical examination of various sources, in the same way we determine historical claims. Considered philosophically, the doctrine that has been historically verified must be related to the eternal truth. So he's thinking, you know, historical facts like, you know, did Jesus really live, Jesus of Nazareth, and are the facts about his life, you know, are historically verifiable. And then the philosophical truth, I think he's thinking about more sort of the doctrine of the atonement that Jesus paid for the sins of mankind, and the sort of idea, Christian idea of salvation by grace through faith, and some of these other doctrinal beliefs. All right, and then he comes to the Bible, and he says, page 184, second to the bottom paragraph, let us assume that the critics have established everything that the scholarly theologian in their happiest moments have ever dreamed to prove about the Bible. These books and no others belong in the canon. That is in the collection of books we call the Bible. The Bible is actually not a single book. It's composed of 66 separate books that have been compiled together in what we know as the Bible. And so he says, let's assume that all the books that we find in the Bible, that all the ones that should be in there are in there, and there aren't any that are missing that should be in there and that aren't in there. So there aren't any extra books, and there aren't any missing books. They are authentic, complete, and their authors are trustworthy. It is as though every letter were divinely inspired. Long parenthetical comment. Furthermore, there is not the slightest contradiction in these holy writings. For let us be careful in formulating our hypothesis. if there is even one, even a word that is problematic, the parentheses of uncertainty begins again, and the critical philological enterprise will lead one astray. So even if it's just, you know, everything looks great, there's one sort of nagging doubt about this one passage, you know, whatever it is. And he says that's going to open up, you know, your doubts, your questions. And so let's assume that all of those things have been taken care of. You have no questions left. Okay, so it comes that everything we hope with respect to the scriptures is firmly established. What follows from this? Has anyone who didn't previously have faith come a single step closer to faith? Of course not. Not a single step closer. For faith isn't produced through academic investigations. It doesn't come directly at all. But on the contrary, it is precisely in the objective analysis that one loses the infinite and passionate concern that is a requisite condition of faith. It's ubiquitous ingredient wherein faith comes into existence. So what's he saying? Somebody want to paraphrase that passage as read? What's his...
You can't get faith by academic investigation. And in doing so, you lose all the passion and personal relationship that you were supposed to be seeking in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So he's saying that you have to pursue Christianity, particularly on a subjective way. You can't approach it objectively.
Yeah, you have to pursue Christianity subjectively, not objectively. Subjectively means through faith, through passion, through belief, through throwing yourself into the religion and believing. Not in trying to analyze the Bible and you know, what would Kierkegaard think about Josh McDowell's book, Evidence Demands a Verdict, and all of those other books which try to show the historical reliability of the Bible and how the canon of Scripture was formed the Encyclopedia of Bible Difficulties, which tries to look at apparently contradictory passages and show how they're not really contradiction. He'd say, look, if you're Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris, these sort of firebrand atheists, or even some sort of apathetic person who compares a belief in Christianity to belief in Santa Claus with the Easter Bunny, and you pick up Josh McDowell's book, or you pick up Who Moved the Stone, another famous apologetic work that tries to prove the resurrection of Jesus was a historical fact. Frank Morris, I think, Who Moved the Stone. You read Gleason Archer's Encyclopedia of Biblical Difficulties. If you're an atheist, if you're or an apathetic agnostic, if you read this book, are you going to say, oh, I was wrong all along, this answers all my questions, I'm going to become a Christian based on this evidence? No, you're going to think, oh, what a bunch of nonsense, right? You're like, yeah, they got a few points, but here's a bunch of other points in its favor. Or you might like look for some, you know, Christian friend to have a really knockdown, drag-out argument just to prove why he's wrong. Or your friend that gave you this book, you're thinking, you're like making a bunch of notes of all the ways you're going to refute it, right? Maybe send them a long email about all the fallacies in this book that your religious friend gave you to try to convert you to the faith. And you might, you know, chide them to say, you know, you should really have your own arguments instead of try to borrow. It's giving these books by these people to borrow arguments from other people. You should have the integrity to have your own arguments. He's not going to, now, so that the person who's an atheist or agnostic, he's not really going to pay much attention to this. On the other hand, what about the religious person? Are they going to, you know, have? Are they going to believe if they do not? Well, they already believe, right? Why do they even need this stuff? Why pour through all these examples? Because they're not going to convince anyone else, and they're not really going to convince themselves either, because they have faith already. So why do they even need this stuff? So his idea is that you can't convince a person of the, you can't get a person to adopt the standpoint of faith through the use of reason and argumentation. They have to make their own personal decision to make a leap of faith. So what do you think about this as a view of religion? Thoughts?
Seems honest.
He's honest? Okay. Anybody else? What about using reason in religion? Is that sort of, yeah?
Why would you ever learn theoretically, you know, things that are worse than good, trying to just up there? some point objectivity has to come into
the brain. So you say at some point you'd need like some objective reasons to believe, otherwise it's why would you do it? One question you might ask is why. First of all, what would W.K. Clifford think about this? It's believing without sufficient evidence, right? What does Clifford say? It's always wrong for anyone, anywhere, at any time, in any state, at any moment of their life, anywhere, on a bus, on a train, it's always wrong to believe with insufficient evidence. But what's Kierkegaard asking you to do? Believe in insufficient evidence. Just take this leap of faith. And Kierkegaard says, if you're going to believe in God or religion, then you need sufficient evidence. Otherwise, you don't have a right to that belief. And you're actually, committing a sin. Paradoxically, right? You use the word sin. You're leaving a stain which can never be wiped away by believing something without sufficient evidence. Other thoughts on using reason in religion or philosophy of religion, Isaac?
Well, I mean, there's even passages in the New Testament talk about questioning everything, including the doctrine itself. So, I mean, even the Bible encourages its readers to examine it itself with reason and logic. So it's not like Christianity is like, whoa, keep reason out of here. Just believe me without reason.
That's a good point. In the New Testament, you have the Apostle Paul speaking on at the Areopagus, Mars Hill, Acts chapter 17. And he's using philosophical arguments to try to convince these pagan philosophers that they should believe in Jesus. And we get to the idea of the resurrection. They scoff at him and they say, all right, well, that's enough of that. You can come back some other time. We can hear some more about that. Like, we've had enough for today. Because they thought the idea of bodily resurrection to them was absurd because they thought that the body was the prison house of the soul. But he's using arguments. When the early Christians, who were Jews, tried to convince their fellow Jews that Jesus was the Jewish Messiah, they used reasons and evidence. They pointed to prophecies that Jesus fulfilled. They showed passages from the Old Testament to try to prove that Jesus was the Messiah. They talked about the fact that there were witnesses to Jesus' resurrection. There were people who'd seen him after he had died. There were people who'd seen him ascend to heaven. And so you see this idea of eyewitness testimony pointed at again and again in the New Testament. So it might be that some of the New Testament writers might have some disagreements with Kierkegaard in that respect. And I think that if you think about this idea that you should just take a leap of faith, you can ask this question.
Going in which direction? Again, this question, which religion? Or, why religion? Are you going to believe in something? Why not believe in yourself?
Why not believe in Marxism? Why not believe in existentialism, the atheistic brand? Why not believe in, I think of some other, a non-religious ideology? Transhumanism, right? This idea of improving the human race through technology. It seems if you're taking a leap of faith, you're going to believe without evidence. Why believe in God without evidence? Why not believe in something else without evidence? Are you still thinking about the payoff? Or again, if you're thinking, okay, believe in God, well, which God are you going to believe in? And Kierkegaard says we should believe in Christianity. But it seems like the next question you'd ask, well, what does Christianity have to recommend it over Buddhism, Hinduism, Shinto, Jainism?
A personal relationship. Which was like Kierkegaard's entire point.
Yeah, so does Christianity offer, what about like Sikhism that emphasizes a personal relationship with God? Or
to get some of the tradition. If you're thinking about, Judaism has this idea too, that God's your heavenly father, and that has that's the idea of a personal relationship. I think of Islam, it's kind of a formal relationship. It's a personal relationship, but it's sort of the relationship between subject and king or something. It's not the idea of an intimate relationship or an informal relationship.
So does Kierkegaard say it should be a personal relationship, that you should have one, or you should?
Yeah, you should have a personal relationship with God. But what I mean, Buddhism, right? Mahayana Buddhism, you have a relationship with the Buddha, or New Age philosophy, you have a relationship with your guardian spirits and the ascended masters, or you know. So it's not like Christianity has a corner on this idea that you have some personal interaction with God. In Hinduism, you know, devotees to Krishna have, you know, relationships with Krishna, which, you know, look on the outside to be the same as with Jesus, where they love Krishna, they praise Krishna, they worship him, and they say they feel the love of Krishna. So that seems that if you're going to say it's just take a leap of faith, well, why Christianity? Why this particular religion? Or which, if not, you know, which religion? It seems like you have to come back to reason to decide which religion. I think Kierkegaard's onto something. I would say that this idea of subjectivity versus objectivity is an important one. And I think he's hit on something in particular, and that's of particular importance, which is this idea that the more doubtful you are about a belief, the less likely you are to act on it and to act on it with passion. So this is true in anything about like your political beliefs. If you're not really sure about politics, you have, you know, well, you know, the liberals say this and they got some good points, and the Democrats they have these points, and then the conservatives have these ideas, and libertarians have these ideas, and you're kind of trying to weigh it all and trying to figure out, and you're like, I'm not sure what I believe. And then you're going to end up a moderate, right? And what do moderates believe in? Nothing. What do they stand for? Nothing. What are their principles? They don't really have any. Why? Because they're not really sure. So if that's your, or they kind of like, they go, I'm like a little bit of this, a little bit of that, kind of mix it together and make some nice, you know, mush. Right? So if you don't have any principles, if you don't have any firm beliefs, then when it comes time to vote, you're like, I don't know if I'll go out and vote, or I'm not really sure who I'll vote for. I'll see like what the 30-second attack ads say on TV, right? So you're not, are you going to go out and wave a sign and protest? Are you going to donate money to a campaign? Well, you're not really sure who you should give money to, so you're not going to do anything, right? You're going to sit at home and kind of have a wait-and-see attitude. So I think that wait-and-see attitude is born of doubt. And so to have a passionate commitment, to have a belief, really means to have a subjective commitment, in a way, as a kind of a leap of faith. Whereas the more objective you are, the more impartial you are, the less passionate you can be. And so there is this conflict between being passionate about what you believe and making sure what you believe is objectively proven by the evidence. Now, ideally, the more evidence you get, the more certain you are. But if you're going to be impartial and use cold, cool reason, you're not going to be as confident in your belief as you will be if you sort of go beyond reason and embrace passion about your belief. And people who are the most passionate and most active, you know, they have a belief which goes beyond the evidence, and that's what allows them to pursue their belief with gusto and do things, and even, you know, sacrifice their own lives for the sake of the cause. If your belief in a cause needs to go beyond reason in order to bring you to that point, or even to just show up at a protest to wave a sign or write your congressman. So it's, if I can distill this down, is there's a conflict between objective, making sure you have the truth, having objective truth, and conflict between making sure you have object of truth and having subject of passion.
Alvin Plantinga talks about this. He's a Christian philosopher, and he says, look, I have faith, and I have, he would say, I have a reasonable belief in God, which does not require me to pore over the latest philosophy journals to make sure that no one has come out with a convincing argument against belief in God, right? I don't have to every day, I don't have to try to find out if somebody has disproved my belief. And I don't have to have like a whole stack of philosophy journals that prove my belief. It's justified as it is. So that's the one approach. The other approach is that, well, you have a certain amount of time in the day. You can spend the time in your day looking for evidence that whether your belief is true, or you can spend it trying to spread those beliefs to other people. You can't do both at the same time. You have to find some way to split it. So the question is, how do you split it? How much time do you spend making sure your belief is true versus how much time do you spend trying to spread that belief to others or acting on that belief and applying that belief? So, and that's, again, that's a tension, and everyone has to make a decision about what the proper proportion is. And there's some people, they spend all their time like, you know, reading the blogs and, you know, books and reading politics all day, and they don't even vote. Sometimes they vote, and that's pretty much it. And voting, you know, voting is overrated because you're just one, what, as particularly in national elections, you're one in a million votes or one in a few hundred thousand. And it doesn't really make that much difference, as opposed to like going out and going to a call bank or give money or being part of a protest or sitting at a table. Those are like significant things, but those require more sacrifice, right? So you think, if I'm going to do that, I got to be really on board with this idea. I have to really believe in it. But how am I going to do that if I don't, you know that it's true? So then you spend all this time investigating, researching, and so on. So, you know, if you have a sort of a more conservative orientation, does that mean you got to, you know, listen to NPR and watch MSNBC and you know, read Mother Jones magazine every week to see all the arguments against your side? And, well, I mean, you could be out there, you know, working for the cause at some Tea Party rally, right? Or harassing the president when it comes to Hillsborough instead of spending your time reading a bunch of left-wing track. On the other hand, if you're like a liberal, you have to listen to Rush Limbaugh every day to make sure that he doesn't have some good arguments against your side. So this again, there's a sort of tension about acting on your belief, applying your belief, as opposed to just making sure your belief is true. And Kierkegaard's hit on this. Again, the problem, though, is he wants to say it's either one or the other, and that you should get rid of reason altogether and kind of take this leap of faith. And that seems to be kind of an extreme position. Let's see. I think what we're going to do is save religious knowledge and human miracles until next Monday, and then next Wednesday we'll talk about moral knowledge. So I'll make those changes in Moodle. So on Monday, make sure to read the section of miracles by David Hume, the section there, and then and we might talk a little bit about belief and will also on Monday, and then on Wednesday we'll be doing moral knowledge in the last chapter, and then last week's going to be political knowledge and review. So I'll see you going for a little early today, and I'll see you guys on Monday. If you're a praying person, pray for snow tomorrow.